I'm Barney Moss-Cohen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. Marcus Samuelson was born in Ethiopia, raised in Sweden, is an acclaimed chef living and cooking in Harlem, down the street from his famous restaurant, Red Rooster. Shortly after it opened 6 years ago, Sam Sifton, writing in the New York Times, called Red Rooster among the most important restaurants in the city. Samuelson has created a place where uptown and downtown can mingle, enjoy music, and dine on cross-cultural soul food. He writes in his new book, The Red Rooster Cookbook, that he spent 2 years trying to figure out how to make a really tasty fried chicken until his friend John Legend told him, just fry the damn bird. There's a recipe for fried yard bird in the book. Samuelson also credits his grandmother Helga for making him a chef and writes about what it was like to cook President Obama's first state dinner in the White House kitchen. He also hosted a fundraiser for Obama at Red Rooster, and in the cookbook there's a recipe for Obama's short ribs. And Marcus Samuelson, nice to have you with us on Radio Times. What a pleasure.
Thank you for having me. It's exciting to be in Philly. I'm always excited to come here.
And my stomach is growling, right? Just thinking about our conversation. Do you have a favorite time in your in your kitchen, or perhaps even in your restaurant?
Yeah, I mean, I love, obviously, there's so many different moments. Restaurant is like a theater, right? And when you're a restaurant worker like me, I've been in love with my profession since I was a child. There is different moments that you love. For example, staff meal is a very important time. A restaurant that serves great staff meals have always a good energy about them. So the customer will see that as well. It's a very important time for everybody to get together. At Red Rooster, it's a very special time because it's also where most of our musicians are setting up, sound checking. So we're having the staff meal between dishwasher, cooks, servers, barbacks, all that is. And, you know, we're hearing this great jazz. But it's very often the time where a dishwasher becomes a cook. Because often the ideas for staff meal come from the prep cooks or from the dishwashers. And that's when you get a chance to look, wow, who did that? This is amazing. It might be a cuisine you're not introduced to, and I love that. That moment is very special.
I'm figuring every kitchen has their own language, their own slang. Apparently, at Red Rooster, French fries are called sexy.
Yeah, I mean they are. I mean, French fries is a whole thing, right? You get them on you eat them. They should be crunchy, and then should just be a right amount of grease around them. And if you're real lucky, you can take that grease and just
there you go,
use it like lipstick, not too much, and it's just salty and good. That's sexy to me.
Absolutely. I do not argue with you at all. What was the thinking, though, behind Red Rooster? And I was reading that after September 11th, you, I think, like a lot of other people, began to kind of think about their life, what they were doing, what they wanted to do. It sounds like this restaurant kind of grew out of some of that tragedy and some of your thinking.
Well, I mean, I think we're all, as creative people, we all sort of reflection of these larger moments that happen in society and how do they impact us and how do we come back to our community with a response that makes sense, maybe only for yourself, but hopefully other people can gravitate to it. And, you know, I'm an immigrant to this country, and it's fascinating. We're talking about this as this very intense moment of diversity and immigrants and refugees. I'm not a refugee. I'm very privileged in that sense to be an immigrant. And I come because it's easier very often to be an immigrant versus a refugee.
Yes.
And like most immigrants, you're in love with America, the idea of America, and you fight for it. And you're very often extremely patriotic about this new country that accepted you. So I came to this America with this idea of diversity and this idea of that I wanted to contribute to the landscape of cooking more than just filling people into my restaurant. And that's something obviously that is important. But besides that, what else could one contribute and share? And after 9/11, I felt like, you know what, I should probably, my energy was at the lowest, and I was really searching. So I said, you know what, let's leave where I'm living right now. Let's move to Harlem and let's learn about that community. And maybe one day I open a restaurant. And it was through talks with my mother that she always said to me that, Marcus, why do we always have to leave our communities to eat your food? She was talking to us as a family. Why do you always trust just bankers' taste versus you didn't grow up with bankers. You grew up with school teachers. You grew up with bus drivers. You grew up with all kinds of people. So she was constantly challenging me to do something affordable within the community. And out of this idea, that's where Red Rooster came to. And then also that I wanted also, as I learned about Harlem, that desperation of, can we change the foot traffic of dining? Can people come into urban communities such as Harlem versus just having all the experiences downtown or elsewhere? So we changed the foot traffic of dining.
You have a great paragraph in here about Harlem. You say, right now, Harlem is delicious. Mm-hmm. And then you describe, in a sense, looking out your standing at your doorway, looking up the street and then down the street and just seeing this world that seems very uniquely Harlem.
Yeah. Well, I mean, Harlem has always been a very diverse community. I think it's important to sort of go back. The restaurant is about connecting the past with the present, and thereof we create something for the future. So, you know, if you go to East Harlem, it's always been Italian-American, and you have restaurants such as Rao's and Patsy's that comes out of there. And you go further in, you have El Barrio, which was always Latin, Puerto Rican, and today is a Mexican-American community predominantly. In the center of Harlem, obviously, it's the roots of the migration, the African-American story coming up, the laborer coming up. And out of that, we got jazz to incredible storytellers in terms of music and writers, of course. And then to the west, it's gone everything from being Irish-American to very diverse communities. So the restaurant celebrates all of that movement. So I think the migration is the core, but also global immigration. So now West Harlem has little West Africa, has a Caribbean community, and also a lot of New Yorkers that moved in too. So the restaurant will always sort of keep its pulse and its core around the foods and the culture around the migration. But we will also have Chinese New Year. We will also celebrate Swedish Midsummer because we can, and it's delicious and it's fun.
This seems like a little detail. I did spend time as a waitress. This was back in the day when you could say waitress.
Yeah.
Now it's server, I guess, or some version of that.
I love waitress. You can still say it. I love waitress.
I happen to like waitress too. But I noticed that you have about a third of the people sitting in your restaurant are walk-ins.
Yes.
And again, that seems like such a sort of nitpicky detail. Mm-hmm. Why is that important, though?
Well, it's very important because our first week when we opened, our restaurant was packed, and a lot of people looked into the window, and they looked kind of like, oh, it's a restaurant for them, and who are them? And what I realized was a friend of mine just said to me, Marcus, I live in this community. I'm not going to make a reservation to your restaurant. I might come home back from work. I'm tired. I may be 15, 20 minutes late. If you're going to be in my community and it's for me, I want to be able to walk in. That's my prerogative and privilege. And it was such a, you know, and I realized also the buy-in of the community. Success would be the buy-in of the community, not just me as a chef coming and implementing my 10 best dishes. So this pushback of letting me know what was up, completely complaining to me and telling me what I needed to do, I loved that. I was like, wow, I've been thinking about this wrong. So this wasn't this great idea that I figured out before. Red Rooster, the success of Red Rooster is also, it's an imperfect endeavor where we constantly have to pivot and change and listen to the community. So we decided, okay, we'll look at a reservation book. A third of those calls are New Yorkers, and New Yorkers are very simple. They say, give me a reservation.
They want what they want, right?
Now! And we don't have that. It's like, don't you know who I am? It's very difficult.
I'm sure.
The visitors, you know, they say, hey, let's go to New York. And the second night, let's go to Harlem. They mostly do that reservation online.
Right.
So then we were able to know, okay, we have the X amount of online reservation, X amount of phone calls. Let's just see and open up. And that's why we have this extremely diverse population in there. You know, it's like a Steve Bannon nightmare, right? It's all kinds
of Steve
people.
Bannon.
It's like all kinds of people getting along, having a good
what
time.
What a horrible thing,
oh,
right?
God.
It's terrible.
And then we're having fun, and then people are hugging and speaking different languages and laughing. And some of them, I'm going to tell you, you don't know this, but there's actually black people sitting next to white people.
I don't believe it. So this I is do a not little, believe that.
It's a little
Never
bit.
Happened.
It's a secret that I want you to know. And there's Chinese people, and there's like, it is all kinds of people. And sometimes they get drunk, and sometimes they go home together.
Oh,
it's
my goodness.
Horrible. I can't stop there.
Well, there's your logo, Steve yeah. Bannon's Nightmare, the
well,
Red Rooster.
I mean, I don't want to give him, I don't want to give him too much credit for that. So, that, you know, that's, but it's you know, it's people love it. I know, not, I'm not sure if Sean Spicer would love it, but like people love it.
You talk about being happy. And I mean, do you feel, have you been sort of searching for that place where you can live and cook and be happy?
You know, I grew up in a time where I knew I wanted to be an ambitious chef and travel the world and be a person of color. There were very few choices. So ambition and happy were coming from two different roots. I mean, you had to be precise and you had to be the best. Not only among the best, you had to be the very best. And I was constantly told that you have to be the very best. And it was constantly also explained that you have to be that. So happy was not something that I associated with being cooking and eating with my grandmother. I associated with Helga, with home, you know, cooking with my dad and my mom, but never in a restaurant. So it took me until cooking for 25 years to realize, oh, you can be happy and have a great restaurant at the same time. So as a chef, I'm searching, right? And to have this enormous conversation with the public is something I don't take for granted. I'm privileged and I appreciate it. So to even open that up and talk about that, it was something that took me a long time because I never associated the two together. It's strange that that must be. Yet I was always very happy with what I have achieved and in the success and the hard work of that. But now I go to work and I smile and I am happy.
Your memoir is Yes, Chef.
Yes, Chef.
Is chef, I mean, are chefs, is that a democracy in the kitchen or is it not necessarily a dictatorship, but that if it's yes, chef, the chef has the final say?
I think it's definitely not a democracy. That will not be a true state, but it's a place where you have a vision and idea and people that you work with come and support you and adds to that vision and idea. And it's like being in a band, right? And where you write the songs and you have the musicians and you play together and you stick together through all types of snowstorms or political endeavors or economical things, and it shapes you as the chefs and team members or band members. And that's why we're not normal. We're very abnormal, and we're misfits very often, but we are in the culinary and hospitality industry.
Let's take a short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. That's Marcus Samuelson, our guest in this hour of Radio Times, chef and owner of Red Rooster, among other restaurants in New York City, wrote a memoir called Yes, Chef, and he's got a new cookbook called Red Rooster Harlem, the Red Rooster Cookbook, the story of food and hustle in Harlem. We'll take a very short break, and then we'll get right back to our conversation. Stay with us. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne talking with Marcus Samuelson. He is a chef. He's also the author of a new cookbook called The Red Rooster Cookbook, based on his restaurant, which is in Harlem, subtitled The Story of Food and Hustle in Harlem. Also appears frequently as a judge on the Food Network's Chopped. And we are talking on Radio Times about food and a bit about his life as well. And I should add, we posted some of his recipes on our Facebook page for cornbread, mac and greens, and killer collards. Give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. In fact, Nick just tweeted, I love dining at Red Rooster. So great when DJs are spinning soul tunes. Mm. Plus, the bathrooms are beautifully styled.
They are.
How important is that?
Yeah. I mean, and the bathrooms are fun because, you know, we really built them. If someone was on a bad date, they could stay in the bathroom and just like, I'm not coming out. I have my champagne. And I'm just having fun. And the images in the bathroom are really from locals that and telling their stories about. It's really about dignity and fun. So that's what you see in the bathroom.
And there was a Red Rooster in Harlem, right? I mean, going back to the 30s, the Prohibition
I mean, there was when I searched for the name, I wanted to have something that a Harlemite knew that this is in and of Harlem. There's a lot of stuff in Harlem and not that many things that are in and of the community. So, and I also wanted a name where these other places like Cotton Club and so on, Black people were allowed to work, but they were not allowed to be guests. So I didn't want to have anything that had that stigma around it. And one of the things that I loved about Red Rooster was a tiny little bar right next to Abyssinia Church. And I read this story about it, and it was this bartender, George, and I said, do you see the hustlers, the police officers, and the politicians? He said, I've had them all. And I loved that because it showed, indicated to me that, A, it was a gay bar. B, in the 40s, to be open for that. And they were called funny people back in the day.
Funny people.
Which I didn't know. And I just thought that was, wow. Well, I know a lot of funny people, and I love them, and I'm part of that. And there was also where politicians could go. So a young Charlotte Rangel and Dave Dinkins went there. But it was also where the maid, when they had the maid nights on Thursday, maids came from all over the New York area to go to the Red Rooster. And it was also where Willie Mays and Nat King Cole, before they went on downtown. So it was this place where it was very diverse. And I was like, wait a minute. I know the artist. I know the community. Let's create a place that is in and of Harlem that also matches its magical energy that Lenox Avenue provides to you, that is extremely diverse, that we have to hold on to and celebrate and don't take for granted.
Why did it take you 2 years to figure out how to make fried chicken?
You know, I still work on my fried chicken.
Is it that hard?
Well, you know, it's also food that you grew up with. Like, I grew up with herring. Which is a little bit different than fried chicken. I grew up with a roasted chicken with my grandmother, but I'm a fish head. You know, I grew up with that. So understanding what does it feel and what does it mean to eat fried chicken without having those memories, that was a different place to cook from. It wasn't just a dish. It was also a cultural dish that had meaning. And then what part, which is all coding, right? Because, you know, the master could have the X kind of meat and the bones were for the others, you know. So it's all this understanding that, culturally understanding that. And then what would be my chef a point of view on it? So I decided dark meat, bone in, skin on. Right?
Sounds good.
And then, right? Thank you. Check. And check, then right. It was putting it in both really a brine and then marinating it, right? Then out of that, then frying it on low heat, then higher heat. The low heat to cook through and the higher heat to create it crispy. So when you eat it, it gives off these incredible fried chicken sounds that should be normal. The crackling of the skin, right, like that. And then the juice from the bone and marinade comes out and it's juicy. So it's both, and then you start licking your fingers. And then you look around and say, can I pick it up again? Can I pick up another one? While, you know, my dining guests might have a knife and fork, but you're like in it. And that's eating a great fried chicken.
And
you know?
Was that good advice from John Legend? Just saying, fry the damn bird?
I mean, John gives me a lot of different advice, but I think that one was good because he understood I was overthinking it. And, you know, as creators, we can do that. We want to deliver something. But we're so nervous about sort of letting it go sometimes, and he was completely right about that.
You used the word misfits.
Yes.
Do you feel like a misfit?
But I think it's a beautiful thing.
I mean, I don't think it's a negative or a critical word.
I mean, I've been at some point, before I was 25 years old, I was an immigrant six times in 7 years, right? I lived in Japan. I lived in Switzerland. I lived in France. I came here. I've traveled abroad. Boy, did I learn from not speaking the language in Japan. So I have to pick up other things, smell, sounds. when you live in France and you don't speak the language, you live in Switzerland. So, yeah, you always kind of feel. But you know what? I wish at this point that I only understood half of what's being said right now politically. It would be a perfect. If you just understand half, sometimes it's better because you just like ignorance is just like it just goes by you. So sometimes you can still contribute by just understanding half or a third of what's being said. It's not always a bad thing.
You mentioned your grandmother, Helga. I mean, it seems like she was, and you wrote about her in your memoir, she was someone that really inspired you to cook, to be a chef perhaps, to travel the world, be open to taste.
My grandmother, Helga, comes from a time when Sweden was poor, which is kind of hard for people to understand that Sweden was a poor country. It was a very poor country. She only had 6 years of education. Wow. And she was an amazing cook. The only other country she'd ever been to was when she walked over to Denmark. But she had a world view through her daughter and through my father. And when he came back and we came back from trips, we had to sit down and explain what was the food in France? What could we eat in Italy? And she wanted to make the pasta the way it was done in Italy. She had her Escoffier book translated. And when I lived in Switzerland, my Sunday calls to her, I had to put in coins, Swiss franc at the time, and I have to go by minute telling her about purple carrots. She's like, how can carrots be purple? I have to tell her about how she couldn't understand that we didn't use the pig feet. Well, how come you don't use them? What happens to the pig feet? Because this was all foods. That was, if you had an animal, you used everything. And she's like, well, how can you get fresh fish in a place where it's landlocked? These were the things that I was talking to my grandmother about. So, yes, she hadn't traveled, but she connected me constantly to a time of eating well, but yet being poor. Those two things was where she came from, but we always ate well.
You did work in a number of restaurants before coming to the U.S., and I was reading about one in particular, perhaps it was in France, with a really scary-sounding chef/owner or chef who was demanding but also violent.
Yeah, I mean, it's a very hard thing to talk about for people that are not in the industry. And coming from that time, and on top of it, obviously, I was always the only black person. And so, like I say, that's obvious, it's so obvious, but it is and it was. But the violence was everywhere.
Really?
So at least it was equally violence. And but I also learned a lot. So I had a very hard time talking about this because these chefs were also icons and they helped me more than anything. But yet there were all these stuff that it was highly, you got a plate thrown in your face. You got hot seared fish thrown in, you know, at you. But, you know, it was also a place of love. So I'm highly, you know, torn about this because you can ask any chef coming from that era for me, we all had the same experience. It wasn't actually just a racial experience. It was more about you were the youngest one in the kitchen and you don't know anything. And if you stick around, we're going to teach you everything. So it was the abuse was fair, if I should say it that way, right? And what can I take from that is to make sure two things, that I create diverse platforms today and bringing people in and not having that type of environment in my kitchen today.
You do not. It doesn't sound like you do anything like that.
No.
But did it make you a better chef?
I think I probably would have got that anywhere, but yes, it did make me a better chef. An appreciation for hard work. You know, if I could take 10% away of that, it would probably be that. But learning about everything from the bottom, I think I went to the best education you possibly could.
Which is starting at the bottom asking lots of questions and observing. I'm assuming with your grandmother, you would cook side by side?
Yes, we did. But you know, there were certain things I couldn't do. I wasn't, you know, you have to roll the meatballs, but maybe not, you know, flip the meatballs in the pan. I had to learn how to clean a fish, but maybe that's not where I started at 7. You know, the knife work maybe came in that later on. But I am so appreciative of my journey and be able today to upload my journey through a book, through the Red Rooster book, or through my restaurant. It's a privilege I don't take for granted, and I work at hard every day.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Marcus Samuelson. We are talking about his life in kitchens and talking specifically about his restaurant in Harlem. And he's got a new book. It's called The Red Rooster Harlem. It's a cookbook based on the recipes that he cooks there in Harlem. And that phone number is 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times to join the conversation. This is a story you have told a lot, but I think it fits nicely into the conversation that we're having about the fact that you were born in Ethiopia.
Yeah.
You and your mom and your sister had to, sounds like, walk something like 75
yeah.
miles
yeah.
in order to get, what, treatment for TB?
Yeah, my mother did not survive, but she was strong enough to walk me and my sister from our tiny little village into the capital.
Yeah.
And, you know, when I look at when I go back to Africa and I, you know, this idea of you, I've never seen a picture of my mother. I've never seen her eyes. So when I go back to Africa and I look at a 20-something young woman with two kids, which is a very common scene that you see, I sometimes think about, could that have been my mother?
Well, sure.
That's how she looked like. I think about the dry food that she carried with her on the journey. And we ate at night because it was a little bit colder. And then getting to the hospital, getting into the hospital. And on top of that, how did we get adopted? You know, there's
yeah.
5,000 kids in there. And
yeah.
how did my sister put us, you know, on top of the line there? There's so many things.
Is that what your sister did? She
yeah.
figured out, and your sister is older than you.
A little bit older
you.
Than me, yes. But it's also the goodness of others, right? There was a nurse there that had three kids on her own. And when we recovered from TB after a couple of months, they said, well, what are we doing with these kids? Which is a very common thing. There's thousands of kids. Well, they don't have any parents. She just said, I'll take them in until we set up a way for them to get adopted. So life is a blend between luck, random incidents, and some a recipe of juju. You know, I don't want to take any of that out. And I'm here because the willingness of a nurse to just say, I don't have a lot, but I can provide a place for them for a couple of months until they go off. This, you know, I will never forget that.
You were pretty little. Do you have actual memories, or is it your sister sort of remembering
yeah.
for you?
It's all really memories that my older sister has really talked to us and talked to me about, and, you know, it's sort of been in stamped with us in terms of. And when I go back to Ethiopia today, it's a place that me and my wife, we go back to every year, and we have our own charity, Three Goats, where we help young children with food and water and so on. But it's really, it gives me such a source of both pride, but also strength. You know, when I go into the hut that we was born, that's actually the same size of this table. And I think about that I was born in a hut.
6 feet by 4 feet.
Yeah, with obviously no electricity and all that stuff. And we lived there. And I can be here sitting talking to you today.
Yeah.
That shows that nothing is impossible.
Do you know why this couple adopted you and your sister? Was there something?
Oh, that's a whole other. That's
is that
another
really?
Hour.
It wasn't.
First of all, they weren't supposed to adopt two kids. Secondly,
Daddy was adopt one.
One. Second, they had a child on her way from Bolivia, but the grandmother just had one in Bolivia. Had one extra request all of a sudden that my mom and dad had to go down and visit Bolivia every year to show that the boy is okay. And my mom was like, we can't, it's our child, we can't fly to Bolivia every year to show what happens if the grandmother changes her mind. That happened 2 days before they got the call to adopt. Hey, there's two kids in Ethiopia here. And they thought about it for 5 minutes and adopted us. So, you know, I don't play the lottery because I already won. But there's so many, like, random things that happen that I just don't want to. You know, I don't
sure.
want to change any of it. So,
did they go down and get you, or did they fly you?
We flew together. Did not come down and get us. They met us in Stockholm, and you know, my dad. By the time they drove us back to Gothenburg, my dad. He had the births. He decided, like, this is my dad. What midday is it today? Okay, it's May 6th. That's your sister's birthday.
We're going to make this up.
Yeah,
right.
In the car drive home. Names, we need names that are worldly. Linda and Marcus. That's your names. Like, it's just.
What was the name you were born with?
Kasahun Sigai and my sister Fantai Sigai.
Oh, wow. So that's your dad.
Getting it done. Get the kids in the car, getting it done.
But I'm trying, were you what, 3 years old at the time?
Around that time, yeah.
So do you have a first impression of Stockholm and Sweden coming from Ethiopia?
What happened was that we saw a lot of food coming out of the refrigerator. And my sister that, you know, I was with her, she's like, what is this? You can just open a door and there's food there. So we were banging on this refrigerator constantly. Mama, oh, I just told this story. We constantly had to push us away from the refrigerator because we were like, what is this place? You can just go somewhere, open up, and there's food, right? So that concept of that refrigerator was so new to us. And my mom was like, this when we ran out of the bed and ran to the refrigerator, kept banging on it. So that's one of the first sort of funny. But like we have so many memories together as a family. Our family looks, you know, I have Korean cousins, I have Jewish auntie, I have white parents, we're all mixed. And I feel so blessed by having that background.
I mean, it sounds like a lot of love in this family.
A lot of fun, a lot of family fun. Craziness.
Is that right?
Yeah, of course. Like any
it's a family,
it's
right?
a family, exactly. Drunk uncle, everything, you know. Have to have that.
I read you were a good soccer player.
Yes.
Like a really good soccer player?
Yeah, but I failed. So
failed how?
Well, I didn't become pro, so I very often look at myself as a failed soccer player. And having that level of teamwork and hard work ethics that I have today comes a lot from being raised in soccer. And I still love it. It's the greatest sport. But it's a lot of that team building and humility. And you realize, started cooking too, that hey, I work hard, but there's lots of kids that work hard. I put my best effort in, and you still didn't do great. So it's a lot of similarities that you can learn. It's a lot of humility in both.
How close did you get to being
very
pro?
Close.
Very
I don't
close.
Even want to talk. We can't talk.
Oh,
about it.
This I'm like sorry. This
awful.
Is a
we talk about it. It was only 35 years ago, so let's. I'm still dealing.
We can
still
talk about being adopted and yes. losing your mother, but we can't talk about soccer, right?
Come back to me at 50.
Really?
We
okay.
can talk about it. Then.
Okay. Well, I know soccer players, so I know what this probably means to you. On that note, let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation with Marcus Samuelson. We're talking about his extraordinary life. We're talking about cooking in his restaurant in Harlem called Red Rooster, how he came to the U.S., his various experiences in restaurants around the world. And we got some open lines at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at whyyradio. Times and check out some of the recipes from his cookbook. We have put them on the homepage. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen, having fun both on and off the air, talking with our guest Marcus Samuelson. Again, chef and owner of a number of restaurants, including Red Rooster. In fact, his new cookbook is called The Red Rooster Cookbook, The Story of Food and Hustle in Harlem. Wrote a memoir a couple of years ago called Yes, Chef. He also appears as a judge on the Food Network's Chopped. You can join us at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Let me get Drew from Doylestown to join our conversation. And Drew, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Chef, I just want to thank you for your continued inspiration. I joined the lovely profession in the mid-90s at 55th and 6th.
I love
and spent
it.
4 years in a lovely basement.
Nice.
And I just want to say how much I respect and honor you as a mentor, even long distance.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate that. And yeah, that basement was iconic. We had floods. We had success. We had a lot of good food, but we also had a lot of hard work and love for one another. So thank you.
Yeah.
Drew, are you a chef somewhere now?
I still am in the field. I'm a banquet chef at Barley Sheaf Farm.
Oh, sure.
In Buckingham, Pennsylvania, Hollycock.
Nice.
voted one of the top romantic restaurants in the country.
There you
Wonderful.
Go. So,
congratulations, Rube. Congratulations.
Thank you so much. No, I cannot thank you enough for your inspiration.
Thank you, sir.
That's great. Thanks, Drew. Thanks for the call to Radio Times. An email from Amy. She said, I'd love to hear your thoughts about the original Westside Aquavit restaurant, although she adds his childhood saga is more important. Wow. You've worked in a lot of different restaurants. Any stories from that one? Memories?
Well, I mean, Aquavit was really an incredible platform for me and place for me to come to New York. First of all, it was a Rockefeller mansion, so I had this incredible sort of history of the Rockefellers there. And the food that came out of that basement, that wasn't a fancy kitchen at all, but our will to... I remember when we started serving vegetarian menu, seven-course vegetarian menu, 1997.
Wow.
And people are like, why would you do that? I said, well, why would you have to feel lesser if you were vegetarian? Or just even the choice of you wanted to have that day. So it was things like that. We were very clear on Scandinavian food at the time was not known that much. And it was an opportunity to really transport people in Manhattan to Scandinavia in a almost a surreal way through taste buds that they might or might not ever have had before. So it's also a fascinating thing because Scandinavians rarely think of ourselves as minorities. And, of course, we're minorities in terms of food. We're a small country, fantastic food, unknown food tales. And, you know, since internet wasn't really effective in terms of food until the early 2000s. So there was this mystique around it that I think today has come out and you know, people can engage in Scandinavian food in other ways than just eating IKEA meatballs.
Well, I was just going to say, I think perhaps this is my limited palate, but I don't think of Scandinavian food. Mm. I mean, and obviously a failing on my part.
No, but I mean, there was two things, right? There was the Swedish chef on the Muppet Show, and then there was
love
IKEA,
that guy.
And then there's IKEA, right? And both
and
have
IKEA,
sort of
right.
helped or you know or made put the Scandinavian food scene on the map, but. There are amazing chefs from Scandinavia. If you think about a restaurant like Noma in Denmark, it's been voted number one restaurant in the world for several years. But besides those highs, there's also great food culture because we have access to nature. All land is public land, which means that you can go foraging anywhere, or you can go fishing anywhere, or hunting anywhere. So that means that you have access, anyone have access to incredible ingredients. And that's something that right there makes you then sets up this culture of preserving, pickling, and understanding natural food. You know, if you have a fresh herring in season, it tastes completely different than a preserved one. If you're going to have the fish char from the northern part of Sweden when it's right. cold, clear waters, that's going to taste different than a farm raised. If you have, like outside my house, we have fresh horseradish, wild chives, if you just pick them up and eat them and chew on them, it's a wildly different taste than something jar. The horseradish will taste more like wasabi, and the chive will taste completely more like a garlic chive. Somewhere. Right. Those are different tastes, but that has nothing to do with money, but just access to you.
Let me read an email from Clifford. What led Mr. Samuelson to travel to so many different countries, and how did he choose where he went? And I'll just add to that, why did you want to come to America?
Well, I wanted to go to different countries because I knew I had to learn a lot. So Japan was clear just to learn about the art of seafood and sushi, different than the seafood that I grew up with in Sweden. France was to work in a 3-star Michelin restaurant, and it was very hard to get into it, but I did. Switzerland was really for my own sense of discipline and more my dad's choice than my choice, but he was right about that.
There's a theme
yes,
here,
there's
I
a
hear.
Theme there. And then America based on diversity. And it was also my father was very, mom, both my father and my mom was very big in this. I said, I was told by a mentor that I could never own a restaurant being a young black chef. Of the quality that I wanted. So he said, well, I think there's an option to go to America. And my father said, well, you specifically should go to New York because I've heard they have a black mayor there. And he said, if they are open enough to vote in a black mayor, they're going to be open enough to go to high-end black-owned restaurant at some point. This is only guessing in the future, right? That's what my dad told me.
And that's fascinating.
That's why I came to America, to be add to the diverse, rich history of cooking, and just believing that I'm willing to work hard, just give me a chance. And America's proven that to me, been the most open country and culture I've ever been to. I know we go through a lot of challenges right now, but I have a lot of faith in that we will come through this, and we will eat good, and we will talk to one another, and we'll create great memories. Although, you know, sometimes you just got to go through stuff.
Sure, absolutely. What is the White House kitchen like? Is it the most well-appointed kitchen on the planet, or would you redesign it if you had a chance? You cooked for President Obama. Was it the first state dinner?
It was President Obama's first state dinner. Yeah. I've been privileged enough to cook for a lot of presidents, President Clinton and President Obama, and many distinguished, wonderful people.
But this is the White House kitchen.
The White House kitchen is very understated, and Chef Chris runs it. She runs a very efficient ship. But I love the garden that Michelle Obama added to it, because it added a level of course we should work with local purveyors. Of course we can just go to the garden and pick up fennel when they're in season, or pumpkin when they're in season. So that was a very, very important move that the First Lady did. And it's something that I'm completely grateful to her for, because it also gave us a platform to talk about fresh food, and getting, hopefully this can, you know, drip down to public schools and all these other institutions that she really fought for. So that garden, that idea of the garden was so much bigger than its size, because it was really an ecosystem for better food in the country.
I've always had the feeling that the president, though, was much more of a hamburgers, French fries guy than Michelle.
They have different tastes, and he loved my short rib, and he likes a lot of different food. But yeah, she's probably a little bit more adventurous eater. But I've lucky enough for them to come to the restaurant a couple of times and cook for them in other occasions. So. They're wonderful guests, and it's always fun to cook and hang with them.
Well, I can only imagine. You also describe, I think it was a fundraiser you had was held at your restaurant, and kind of kept on the quiet. Yeah. But then all of a sudden, when people realized that President Obama was there, people just went crazy, right?
It was amazing. It was one of the days where, you know, Philly is a sports town, so, you know, I always said it would be like the Knicks and the Yankees won. And the same day, like the NBA championship and the World Series on the same day. And the party was in Harlem, right? People were just, walking, celebrating. People had all these Obama cutouts and charged $1 to take a picture. People figured out how to be entrepreneurial. It's Harlem. People figured out pretty fast. But it was really a celebration. And afterwards, my team made sweet potato donuts for all the cops that worked overtime, and we ran over with it. I'm like, this is a day that I will remember for the rest of my life.
I think there's some sweet potato donut recipe in this book, right?
I should have. My bad. I should have brought some here.
You should have.
I know. It's bad. We blame it on the snowstorm.
Let me get Charles from looks like Southwest Philly to join us. Hi, Charles. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, how you doing this morning?
Good. How are you?
Change of pace, Marty.
Yes, indeed. I know. Taking a little break from politics, but go ahead, Charles.
Well, food is politics. What are you talking about?
Yeah, exactly. Another way of talking about politics.
Oh, yes. Right.
Go ahead, Charles.
Well, what I wanted to ask your guest is, how do you merge these different flavor profiles? I'm kind of a self-taught chef.
Great.
And I have worked in a restaurant, but how do you go about, what goes into your thinking when you are developing or merging these various flavor profiles that you've been exposed to? And I'm getting to your restaurant. I just bought your book online.
Oh, cool. See you uptown. Well, first, I think this is a great question. I look at things as, first of all, I think about texture, right? Because to get to a flavor, the texture is very important. It needs to be crunchy when it needs to be crunchy, it needs to be soft when it needs to be soft. And then I think about sour, sweet, bitter. Is there a note of sour? Is there a note of sweet? Is there a note of bitter? Can this dish actually, can you experience umami in this dish?
Which is
not in everything. So then if you're not, you put that one aside. Then after that, I think about actually, okay, which ingredient would support that. So if you take something like a fried chicken that we just talked about, right? So the texture has to be, the skin has to be crispy and crunchy. And how can I drive that to the max? But it also has to be soft and moist inside. So how do I make it ultra soft? Now, what is the heat combination that would make you go back for a second bite? Well, that would be a smoky chili note with a little bit of sweet and a little bit of salt. Now, if I would dust that, let's say, in Parmesan cheese, I'm just saying, maybe I wouldn't do, then you would experience umami. But now I'm forcing it. It's not a flavor that you need to have in that dish. So I'm taking umami out. What is my bitter note? Well, the collards are intuitively bitter. So I think about it from all of this different level. Then the specific ingredient support, which would be spices or the techniques, are secondary after that. But that's the way I think about it.
Charles, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. You describe yourself as a pickle guy.
Yes.
Perhaps growing up in Sweden.
Well, it's also there's something about celebrating last year's harvest. Because I remember picking that stuff, and then also I remember jarring it and putting the note, October 1984, you know, down and running down to the basement faster than my sister, you know, or maybe ripping off her label or whatever we were not supposed to do, or mixing labels from last season.
I think so your father wouldn't like that.
I know. Well, you're right about that. But so it's that thing when I eat a pickle, it's not just a pickle I think about. Oh, maybe I stuck my hand and got maybe I have a scar from last year's summer. It's all of that stuff that goes into the pickle.
A tweet from Christo. What's your favorite wild mushroom? Do you have one?
Ooh, yeah, no, absolutely. First of all, I would say chanterelles because they're so beautiful in the woods, in the natural woods itself. They're different types of chanterelles, but I love just picking them and they look, they're just yellow and bust out. But the other thing is, when people go foraging, they put it on Facebook. That's the opposite. My grandma was always, if you find a good mushroom place, shh.
Don't tell anyone.
Don't tell anyone. So don't Instagram when you go find a place. I'm like, that shows me you have no reason to be in the woods. Like, you're an urbanite. Stay home.
What should every kitchen have, do you think? The one thing.
There's a couple of things. I think a cast iron skillet is always good because there's so many different things. Don't put it in the dishwasher. You need a good cutting board that you can sort of wipe down but use for many things. You need a good knife, maybe just one or two, but you need to do not put it in the dishwasher. I still tell my wife this, by the way, so I'm learning at home. Don't put it in the dishwasher. So there's a couple of things in that. And then have fun. Get in there. The kitchen is no good if they just look nice. Be in there. Create memories.
Are you a cleaner-upper?
I am.
Do you clean as you go?
I clean as I go, but then afterward I want to eat and then go all in. Right? I hate to leave it for the next day. I want to sort of, but I don't want to, the food has to be warm and hot and we have to celebrate that moment and sit. And then I don't mind listening to great music and cleaning up. But my wife is more like, we need to clean up before dinner. I said, no, we clean up after dinner. Do you have advice on that?
I can go either way, so depending on my mood. Yeah. Well, your book does include a playlist, so it's important to listen to music while cooking. In fact, we're going to close with Charlie Parker's Chasing the Bird
in honor Good choice.
Of your recipe there. But just do you, in your restaurant at home, the music is on?
Music is part of describing our narrative, and it sets the tone of what Red Rooster is. The food does too, the hospitality, but without art and music, we would be nowhere. This time, this moment, imagine if you pulled music away too, I wouldn't even imagine what it would be like living.
Does it feel like, I mean, as an immigrant, does it feel like a scary time for you?
It's
worrisome?
Yes, it's very worrisome. And a couple of weekends ago, I cried. You know, I was that guy coming to America with a beacon of hope. I've invested everything I have into this country. I came with $300. Today I'm fortunate enough to have over 300 employees, and I don't take that lightly. But we work very hard as all people. And if you take immigrants out of our industry, we wouldn't have an industry. So let's celebrate each other rather than hate on each other, and let's eat well.
Marcus Samuelson, it's been such a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of the show, and it's produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Trine Nuri. And we do want to close things out with one of the songs listed in his new cookbook, and this is Charlie Parker, Chasing the Bird. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen. Thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.